From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro.
Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we'll discover an alarming mental health trend in Asian American women, higher rates of depression and suicide.
We're really at a point where we only know that there is a problem. We don't know what is the true source of that problem.
Then we hear about the struggle to find translation services for a growing number of Spanish speakers.
When I work, I need to be paid the rate that this is worth.
And who's that spying on your neighborhood mosque?
Because we recognize that it is incredibly frightening when you have any interaction with someone who has a gun and a badge.
Immigrant communities and the unique challenges they face. That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. A couple of weeks ago, we began our series on Asian American mental health. We introduced you to the Liu family, who run a support group in Oakland to help Chinese families navigate the complex American healthcare system.
Still, sometimes I don't quite 100% catch everything, you know, after being here for more than 20 years.
So that's why we would like to share this information with other family.
Their hope is to remove barriers to care, including stigma, and get families to open up to treatment. Asian Americans tend to wait longer before seeking mental health care and often have more serious problems when they finally see a specialist. This plays into a surprising statistic among Asian American women. The CDC reports that young Asian American women have the second highest suicide rate among their age group. The same goes for Asian American women over 65. In the second installment of our series, Asian American Mental Health Inside Out, KALW's Erica Mu introduces us to two women whose stories shed light on that statistic.
The two women you're about to meet, both are technically Asian American, but they couldn't have more different backgrounds. Isabel Thuy Pilo is half Vietnamese, half French.
I was born in France and I grew up in France, but I came to the U.S. when I was 19.
Denise Sugita is fourth-generation Japanese-American.
And I'm from Southern California, a smaller area called Ontario.
But at the age of 19, Denise and Isabel both ended up at the same crossroads. Each woman tried to kill herself. Now, what led Denise and Isabel to that point is a combination of factors, including their life circumstances and their mental health. Let's start with Denise Sugita. When you meet Denise, you might think, she's nice, upbeat.
I'm really passionate about social justice and making changes in the communities.
Denise is 28 years old. She lives in Berkeley and works on a campaign for underserved youth. She's not an outspoken advocate type, though. She's quiet, has trouble making eye contact when she talks about herself and her family.
Like, since I was really, really little, just having the first memories of me hiding in my room, like, holding my dolls or just trying to comfort myself, just hearing my mother and father yelling at each other and my dad, like, me throwing dishes around.
As she says this, she pushes up her glasses with her thin hands and looks to the table.
I remember feeling a lot of emotions of fear, since I was really young, and I don't know, I think maybe it's carried on to me with my adult life.
Denise tells me school life was also really lonely. Thousands of miles away, in France, Isabel Thuy Pilo felt the same way. Growing up, her Asian features made her an outcast among her peers and even her extended family.
My mother, she was not accepted by my father's family in France, and we were always treated, her and I, as total, not only stranger, also, but very foreign and like we came from another planet.
Today, Isabel teaches at SF State University. She's beautiful, confident, a poet and an artist. Identities she wouldn't have even dreamed about as a child.
For example, I remember when people will talk about me when I was present and they will use a word like she, I was really happy because it reminded me that I was a human being and not it.
Like Denise, she remembers violent fights between her parents. Both women struggled through middle school and then high school. And at age 19, both came to the same tipping point.
This is a journal that I've kept since I was 19 and just captured, I think, a few months of my life.
Denise flips through a thick, black, leather-bound journal. She reaches one particular entry, dated December 2nd, 2002. Denise was still living at home in Ontario at the time.
One of the last sentences, it says, "I can hear my mom and grandmother talking. I think they want to call poison control or something."
When Denise reads the entry, it sounds like she's reading someone else's words. But when she describes the day's events, she shifts in her seat and explains. That night, she was in the family bathroom, and she reached for a bottle of pills.
So I just was at the sink, just, I think I poured a lot in my mouth and just got the sink water and just started drinking, just took that whole bottle. Yeah.
Denise's memories after that are a little fuzzy. She remembers her sister finding her throwing up on the bathroom floor, her mother and grandmother panicking and yelling at each other, the 911 phone call, and waking up in the hospital.
And I think I was just upset. I was angry. I wish I didn't wake up.
At the same age, Isabel was in France. She was suffering so much from her isolation that she even had trouble speaking.
From birth to 19, I was totally silent. I was mute, actually. When I tried to speak, I was stuttering. It's not a natural condition, and it has nothing to do with being Asian or having any Asian blood. This silence was forced on me because of my environment, because I was not seen as it was my place to speak. And when you cannot speak, you can internalize it, and it can be self-destructive.
So much so that at the age of 19, Isabel also tried to commit suicide. She wouldn't describe what happened that day to push her over the edge, but she did admit this.
I made a few attempts. I never told anyone. And even in the U.S., actually, I think I had that happened again a few years later. I had nobody to talk to.
There's a cultural practice of dealing with your distress and your feelings, your negative feelings, difficult feelings, on your own before burdening others with them.
That's Joyce Chu, a clinical psychologist in Palo Alto. Now, there's no single indicator that says one person's more likely to attempt suicide than another. There's still very little known about why it happens at all, much less in Asian American women. But Chu says that experts do know that professional help for young women like Denise and Isabel doesn't come early enough, if at all.
By the time they finally seek professional help, the severity of their mental health problems are much higher than compared to every other group.
Also, if you met someone who was suffering from depression or having suicidal thoughts, Chu says you might not know it.
The literature shows that the Asian Americans tend to express their distress more in their body rather than in emotion terms. So if you talk to an Asian American person who's depressed, they might not say, "Hey, I'm sad and I cry every day and I feel blue." The questions that we tend to ask to assess for depression, instead they might say, "Hey, I have a headache, I have a stomach ache."
And so it's not surprising that psychiatrists often miss these signals. That's assuming that the patient comes in to see a doctor at all. After their first suicide attempts, Isabel and Denise took divergent paths when it came to their mental illness. Denise sought therapy, even though she lacked support from her family.
As far as treatment goes, too, I've done both inpatient and outpatient treatment. And I did group therapy. I tried antidepressants.
But so far they haven't worked, Denise says. Her last suicide attempt was in 2010, when she was 26 years old.
I still feel the same way about life. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know if I could get better or not get better. Yeah, it's just really frustrating, I think, for me.
Denise says she's still depressed and not getting help. But at least now she's able to talk about it and is an open advocate for others to seek treatment early on. When Isabel was Denise's age, she still hadn't addressed her suicide attempts.
I have put a lot of energy and drive to move forward and forget the person I was, because I'm not very proud of it. I want to kill her. I want to like, you know, she never happened.
When Isabel moved to the U.S., she says her English wasn't good enough to get treatment. Besides, she didn't have money or insurance. It wasn't until her mid-40s that she was ready to accept her former self. And that's when she reached out to Asian American artist Cynthia Tom.
I'm actually a visual artist, mainly doing surreal paintings and art installations that deal with social justice for women.
Cynthia asked Isabel an important question that would change the course of her mental health.
If you had a place of your own, what would it be?
Cynthia created and directs an art project called A Place of Her Own with the Asian American Women Artists Association. When she first started the project, she didn't know just how therapeutic a place of her own would be for participants like Isabel.
And she created this wonderful kind of nest of beautiful cotton strings and yarns and bamboo slats. And
put a feather on top of it. And the feather is a symbol that reminded me of my last suicide attempt or thought of committed suicide when I was in my 20s. Because I had this little feather coming from the ceiling just when I was really in a bad space. And I just thought maybe it was one of my ancestors being there for me, because I didn't think my parents were for me. I didn't have a community. I didn't have a people. But I had this feather. And when that feather came into my hand, that's one very day, I changed my life around.
In the fall of 2010, Isabel showed her work at the Driftwood Salon in San Francisco. She enjoyed A Place of Her Own so much that she participated again in 2011.
And the reason I liked the art, the project, is because I didn't have to speak. Because it has to be, I didn't have to explain.
Cynthia Tom says that is the key benefit of art therapy. The ability to acknowledge past trauma without having to articulate it first. Still, Cynthia says, it's not a replacement for treatment. But Isabel agrees that her experience participating in the project has helped her heal from her past.
It's a slow process where I can start to speak a little bit more about this, or write about a little bit more about it, or make space for me to reflect on those times.
For both Isabel and Denise, healing from a suicide attempt isn't something that's going to happen overnight, or in 1 year, or through one art project. It's something they're going to carry with them for the rest of their lives. But both women are beginning to find the courage to release what for so long they thought they had to hold inside. In San Francisco, I'm Erica Mu for Cross Currents.
Erica Mu has been reporting on Asian American mental health as part of the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships, a program of the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism. If you or a loved one needs support, you can visit our website for a list of organizations who can help find you treatment. We're at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For immigrant communities, language is one of the largest barriers to accessing the services they need, even large immigrant populations like the Spanish-speaking community. As the number of Spanish speakers grows across the country, public services must keep up with critical translation needs. But paying for interpreters and translators isn't easy during hard economic times. In Nevada, that strain is evident in the state's cash-strapped court system. From the Public Radio Project Fronteras, reporter Jude Joffe Block brings us this report.
It's midday, and Carol Partigian is rushing to an appointment at the Clark County Jail downtown. She's the only Spanish language interpreter in the county public defender's office, which means she's usually in a hurry.
With the 100-plus attorneys that we have in the office, it's very hard for one person to be able to help everybody.
Last year alone, those 100-plus public defenders handled roughly 4,000 to 5,000 cases with Spanish-speaking defendants, about 30% of their caseload. They need more help, more staff interpreters, but there's no money to pay them. Inside the jail, Partigian waits in a small room with public defender Steve Yeager for a guard to bring in his client.
We really wouldn't have all that much to talk about if Carol weren't here. I mean, I speak some Spanish, but obviously I'm not fluent, so it would probably leave us just looking at each other and trying to communicate.
The inmate comes in wearing a blue uniform. Yeager begins chatting, and Partigian jumps in, switching from English to Spanish, Spanish to English, trying to choose the equivalent words in each language.
Has somebody interviewed you yet?
The client's sentencing date for a minor drug offense is coming up, and Yeager asks her if she's already had an interview with the probation office. Partigian interprets her response.
Yes, the detail was that when they were interviewing me, they had the paper of another person. It wasn't my paper.
They had the wrong person?
Sí,
me dijeron que yo estaba en El Paso, Texas, y que me agarraron en la frontera con marihuana. Yo no soy esa persona.
They said that they arrested me in El Paso, Texas, and that I had possession of marijuana. That's not me.
It's a mistake that Yeager can get fixed, but the exchange shows the kind of critical errors that could plague a case if attorney and client can't properly communicate. Afterwards, Partigian explains that's why she does what she does.
If I was in a country where I didn't speak the language and are being accused of something, I would like somebody to be able to help me understand what my attorney is saying.
Essentially, she's an intermediary in the sacred lawyer-client relationship. The stakes are high, since any mistake on her part could have lasting consequences. But there isn't much time to think about that for now. She's got to get to her next appointment.
If I'm late, then all the others will be late. If I cannot make it, then they call the court interpreter's office.
That's the office that oversees the certified interpreters in Clark County courts. But they're experiencing their own resource crunch. Recently, the 20 Spanish interpreters who contract with the county got a 28% pay cut to their hourly wage.
When I work, I need to be paid the rate that this is worth.
That's Judy Jenner, a certified court interpreter and president of the Nevada Interpreters and Translators Association.
And I think the rate that Clark County is willing to pay now stands in no relation to the level of education and the expertise that you need to do this job.
Jenner is among a handful of interpreters who refuse to sign the new contract with Clark County. Others say they're deliberately cutting back their hours in court to work in the private sector, which can pay three times more. But meanwhile, the need for their services isn't going away.
The reality of America in 2012 is we have these people who don't speak the language. How are we going to give them access? And interpreting is the only way until somebody invents a robot where you push a button and out comes the interpreting.
There are no robots yet, and if there are fewer court interpreters, the already maxed out court system can expect more delays. In Las Vegas, I'm Jude Joffe Blanc.
Reporter Jude Joffe Blanc comes to us as part of the public radio project Fronteras, which explores the story around our borders. We'd like to hear your experiences with bilingualism and dealing with the public sector. Post on our Facebook page, KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Muslim immigrant communities are relatively newer and smaller than East Asians or Latinos, but they get more than their share of attention. Since 9/11, surveillance of Muslims has been on the rise. New York City made national news in February when the Associated Press broke the story about the NYPD spying on area mosques. Here's one of the story's authors, Matt Apuzzo, who won a Pulitzer Prize for that reporting, talking on the PBS NewsHour.
They are building these profiles of where Muslims live, eat, shop, pray, where they watch sports, where they go to internet cafes. It's an incredible process by which they're bringing in information about the Northeast Muslims.
Well, about a month later in March, we received similar news much closer to home. The ACLU announced it had documents showing that the FBI spied on mosques here in the Bay Area between 2004 and 2008. Zahra Bilu is executive director of the Bay Area chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which is working with the ACLU on the issue. She came by our studios, and I asked her what the federal agents actually did.
So they would visit these mosques under the guise of building community relationships, really sort of trying to build trust with the community, saying, we're here to protect and serve. We want you to get to know us so that you always have a contact at the FBI. And because of this guise of outreach, many leaders and activists opened up to the FBI. They thought, you know, it's really important for us to have this relationship with law enforcement. And what we learned was that this was, in fact, a betrayal of the community because these weren't outreach visits. What was happening was you would have agents go in, do a visit, take all sorts of notes detailing everything from who's Sunni or Shia to how many women are in the room and who's planning on, you know, going on the pilgrimage to Mecca, and then putting that information in intelligence files and sharing it with the intelligence units in the FBI and also outside of the FBI. So it was shared with other agencies as well. And that's incredibly frightening, and the community feels really betrayed.
The Associated Press just won a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting outing this NYPD program that spied on the New York and New Jersey Muslim populations. You know, we San Franciscans like to think we do things differently here. And do we know if SFPD may be doing the same?
So we're working on a campaign right now in San Francisco through a group called the Coalition for a Safe San Francisco that is looking to pass an ordinance that would put into place protections to ensure that SFPD does not become the next NYPD. Many major cities across the country have what are called joint terrorism task forces, where the FBI and the SFPD or the local agencies will collaborate to work on counterterrorism issues. And so in San Francisco, there is such an agency. The SFPD has anywhere from 2 to 3 officers placed there full time at any given day. And for the 2 years that we've been working on this campaign, what's been most interesting is this conflict about which standards SFPD officers are accountable to. San Francisco leadership says, well, they're accountable to our standards and our local values and our civil rights protections. And the FBI says, no, SFPD officers who are assigned to work with us are only accountable to the FBI standards. We know that federal law enforcement civil rights protections are a floor, not a ceiling. And particularly in a national security context 10 years post 9/11, that floor has really sunk. And so it's really important that San Francisco officers are held accountable to San Francisco standards.
So the FBI says, you know, specifically about the 2004 to 2008 documents, that was then and this is now. You know, we've built some good relationships in the Bay Area Muslim community. So what's the response to that?
The response to the FBI's posturing that this has changed is contradicted by the simple fact that there are documents that continue to note this kind of outreach happening even past 2008. And so though the policies may have changed at some level, we continue to see this type of problematic outreach and or mapping of the Muslim community happening even today.
Mapping.
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate word, is that they are drawing out where the mosques are, where the Yemenis are, where the Sunnis are, where the Shias are, who is devout and who is not. And it's incredibly frightening to see law enforcement taking account of our religious beliefs and practices.
And when they come for kind of an outreach visit, what does it look like? What does it look like if you're kind of there, a fly on the wall? What do you see?
A lot of times they are attending open house events or interfaith events where everyone is invited and the doors are open.
And they come, they say, we are FBI.
A lot of times they will identify themselves as, you know, I am, you know, such and such with the outreach unit of the San Francisco FBI office. And so they'll register that way. They're not hiding in most cases. I mean, and there's definitely cases and complaints of law enforcement going into mosques to spy undercover. And I think that's a whole separate conversation. But in these cases, in outreach cases, they are identifying themselves as FBI. When there was an arson at one of the Tennessee mosques in 2010, it followed sort of a number of other hate incidents. And as a result, the FBI started attending the mosque just once in a while, dropping in, hanging out in the back. And they meant well. And they meant to, you know, assure the community that they had law enforcement there to help them. But it frightened people because we also know about all of the other really problematic practices that the FBI engages in. and an interesting sort of comparison between the targeting of the FBI and the Muslim community and how that undermines trust is an example that's used in secure communities conversations. Many people argue that when local police departments engage in secure communities, which requires that they submit information about all arrests to ICE, that victims of domestic violence are afraid to call law enforcement because they want to call law enforcement so that the beating will stop, not so that the children, the parent of their children will be deported. And so they need to be able to trust law enforcement to get help on the issues that they need help on. Similarly, in the Muslim community, as the FBI continues to engage in this, people are afraid to call in hate crimes because they don't want their name to end up in an intelligence file.
Zahra Bilu is executive director of the Bay Area chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And we'd like to hear your take. Should mosques be spied on in a post-9/11 world, or should the FBI be held accountable for that? Leave a message on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Brian Flagg, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jordan Katz, RTM's Konahovs, Erica Mu, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Isaac Silk, and Mariel Wallof. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.